Is the Santa Claus rally real?
This is Jerry Toome of Smart Money, a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services with Cornerstone President and Founder, Jerry Toome. Jerry Toome is a certified financial planner. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member, FINRA, and SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services and Independent Financial Group, LLC, are unaffiliated entities. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Toome of Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station, or its management, or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. We are here to talk about your finances, investments, and the economy, and we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.
Welcome to Smart Money with Jerry Toome. This is Michael Williams. We got a lot for you today. Of course, we'll update you on our outlook on the stocks, the economy, the Fed. But we're also going to get into Doge, the Department of Government Efficiency that Trump's bringing on board, and other things that's going on now that Trump's going to be president. But first, is the Santa Claus rally a real thing, Jerry?
Oh, I believe it is. I mean, if you look at the stats, there are exceptions to this rule. I remember 2018 was an exception that kind of had coincidentally hit when Trump's first round of trade hikes, you know, his tariffs hit. All of it kind of, there was a combination of that and the Fed, I think, that caused a mini bear market in 2018. You've had crashes like the crash of 87. But the vast majority of the time, everybody that's ever done a study on this concludes that November and December are normally your best months of the year for performance for the market.
Doesn't always work, but it's a trend that tends to
work. Past performance, no guarantee future results. It looks like it is real to me. There's nothing that I can see right now that stops this rally in the short run. I would not be surprised if there's a big reassessment starting in January. There's always a reassessment in January. So right now, if you think about what's going on, the money managers are sprinting toward the tape. They're like racers, and they're sprinting to see who can break the tape to be the winner and get the gold medal and so forth. That's essentially what they're all doing right now, and a lot of the winners that have been winning this year are winning again. So the relative strength hasn't shifted a whole lot. I wondered if it was going to shift away from technology into other areas like small cap and so forth and value, and the answer is so far, no. Maybe next year. Next year could be quite different, as a matter of fact. So if you look at the history of the market, most of the time, and I don't have all the stats on this in front of me, but most of the time the market has positive results in November and December, and they're usually the best months of the year. I was expecting a bear market to start sooner rather than later, and I was wrong on that, clearly. So I think I'm not going to completely retract what I wrote in the election blues, but at the same time, I think clearly I was premature. So we'll talk about that more after the first of the year, but I think for now, the race is on to see what happens. Right now, we've got 95% of the companies in the S&P 500, this is according to Ned Davis, have had increase in their earnings per share. 75% of them have increase in their earnings per share. But, and again, I'm not trying to be negative. I'm not trying to throw a wet towel on what's going on in the market. Be happy. It's good season right now. I hope you didn't overload on turkey and get trampled by a Black Friday sale at the department store. I don't know if we still have those fist fights that, you know, over Black Friday.
I think it's not as much now that you get Cyber Monday.
Oh, okay. Well, that helps. But anyway, 75% of the companies out there in the S&P so far reported growing earnings per sale, or earnings per share, rather. What's the growth rate? This is important because there are two components to stock performance. One is growth. One is the earnings or growth. Two is what we call the multiple. Now, a lot of people don't think that through or are not really that familiar with the term. What is a multiple? A multiple is what you're willing to pay for a dollar worth of growth. So if the market were priced at a price-earnings ratio of 10, like it was in 1982 when John Templeton said it's the greatest time in the world to buy American stocks, which I think he turned out to be prophetically correct, then essentially, and I think the P.E. ratio actually got down to 8, if I remember right, in 1982, just absurd compared to where we are now. Right now, the earnings per share is, you know, it depends on which stocks you're looking at. But the Nifty, the Magnificent Seven are running in the 35 to 60 range. And I remember we used to have a debate. Investors Business Daily used to have a debate, and they said, is it justifiable to see earnings per share on fast-growing companies over 30%, over 30 on a P.E. ratio? And the answer clearly was yes, until it wasn't. And it wasn't after the next crash. So anyway, we have a 5.8% growth rate. Okay, that's what I would categorize as healthy. 5.8% growth rate is healthy. It's not stunning, but it's healthy. Now, out of the sectors, 7 out of the 11 sectors for the S&P 500 had year-over-year earnings growth. 4 of the sectors had declines. So 4 out of 11, to me, that's not a stunning, okay, I'm in Vegas, and I don't do Vegas, but just using this as an analogy, I put, you know, I bet on red, and the little ball bounced around and landed on red, and I had all my chips on red. I wouldn't say it's that kind of a victory. In other words, it's a positive. And I'm not trying to be negative. I'm not trying to say, hey, there's always a cloud behind every ray of sunshine kind of thing. But 7 out of 11 had positive year-over-year earnings growth. 4 of the 11 sectors S&P did not. Okay, so two-thirds, this is rounded off, two-thirds were positive and one-third was negative. To me, that's not a stunning historic bull market, but it is. If you look at the numbers for this year, it's right. An incredibly good bull market. Here's the projections, though, that analysts have for next year, because what's going to happen normally, what happens most years is they sprint to the, they're going to probably ride the current winners through the first part of January, the first week of January, maybe into the third week of January. Historically, if you look at the Santa Claus rally, and we've talked about this ad infinitum, I guess we talk about it just about every year. Normally, the two best months of the year, September, or rather in November and December, and usually you have a correction September, October. This year, we didn't have much of a correction. We had a bit of a correction in August, but I wouldn't call it a really serious one. But here's what the analysts are projecting for next year. Earnings, again, I'm quoting Ned Davis's newsletter. And Ned Davis, by the way, of our, we read subscriptions from people like Ned Davis, Alpine Macro, and Bank Credit Analyst. I would say Ned Davis has been the most accurate of the three that we work with. And but they're starting to be cautious. Okay, wait. The most optimistic group of those that we like has started to be a bit cautious right now. They're not,
because most of this year they've just been updating us on what's going on and their outlook.
Continuing to say it's still a bull.
Now they're kind of saying, well, it's still a bull. They're still positive on stocks.
Right.
But here's a warning sign.
Exactly. And Ned Davis Sr., who actually started this service back in the 70s, he said, number one, I'm not going to fight the Fed. The Fed's lowering interest rates. Number two, I'm not going to fight the tape, which, of course, we don't have ticker tapes anymore, but we did in that day. That's what it's called. If the trend is your friend, Marty Zweig said, stay with it. He said, I'm not going to fight either of those two, but I'm starting to see concerns about sometime next year. We don't know when exactly. The analysts are projecting going to the moon again, of course. Quarter one, earnings growth of 12.7. Quarter two, earnings of mere 12.1 growth. Now, remember the context. I just said that the earnings growth so far, with 95% of the S&P 500 reporting, earnings growth rate is 5.8. First quarter, they're projecting 12.7. Second quarter, 12.1. Third quarter, 15.3. Fourth quarter, 17. All right. Now, again, we don't know that this is going to be another bear market. I think we still could have one. I don't think it's going to be a rip-roaring recession. I still think we could have another crash. I still think it could be related to geopolitics. We just don't know. But what we do know is I just color me more than skeptical on those numbers. I don't see any chance that we're going to accelerate that much. The Fed will likely cut rates some more, but they're not going to go into great massive cuts. Why? Because the economy is not tanking at this point. If the economy tanks next year, it would be something, a black swan type event, something we're unforeseen right now that would cause the economy to tank. And right now it doesn't, you know, there's nothing that you can see. You can't predict that that might happen. You can't predict it won't happen. All you can tell you is right now it hasn't happened yet. So the bottom line is, to project those kind of earnings growth to me is crazy, but that's what happens with Wall Street. So anyway, the issue is stocks, the Santa Claus rally, in my opinion, is real. A lot of it is based on the fact that there's year-end tax loss selling that has to occur with mutual funds. And those basically happen usually in September and October. Then they redeploy the money back into the stock market. They get rid of the dogs that they don't want to show up on the quarterly statements that are sent out. And so that's kind of how this whole thing works. Usually Santa Claus rally lasts until sometime in January. Then there's the reassessment phase. So the question is, when does the reassessment phase occur and what are they reassessing to? And the answer to that is it's too soon to tell.
Meaning they're reconsidering what they have in their portfolio.
Right.
And they may want to do some selling to revamp what's
they may want to say, okay, the sector leaders from last year, we're going to go a completely different way. So the issue is they'll be reassessing, A, the bull market, and B, they'll be reassessing which stocks do they want to own for the growth managers. And that normally starts sometime late in January and February. So oftentimes you have a correction of some sort in February. Right now, that's the way it looks. So I think Santa's off on his sleigh, fills with lots of goodies and all that kind of fun stuff. And it'd be shocked to me to see any meaningful correction in the month of December. But I hope you've had a good Thanksgiving and didn't eat too much turkey along the way.
Right. So we think Santa's going to bring us some presents for the market. But again, it's not a guarantee. There are just trends. There have been years he brought coal. But it's looking good for this year.
The usually if you get coal from Santa, it starts before December.
Right.
It starts in October or
and just carries
or
over.
September and carries on. Right.
Yeah, the warning signs that Ned Davis is bringing up, they tend to say looking towards 2025.
Right.
So they're still positive for now.
That's exactly
so
right.
So that's the markets update. What about our economy?
Economy is still kind of cranking along, slow and steady. The big issue, again, number one, I think we've got to look at it next year. The Fed is highly unlikely to cut interest rates a lot into an expanding economy. If the economy doesn't go into a stumble here, then they're not going to cut rates a lot more. Rates are about as low as they can go with inflation being the problem it is. Inflation is not accelerating, but it's not going away. It's just staying constant. And the Fed, at this point, they've got to make one or two decisions. They've either got to be like the Arthur Burns Fed in the 1970s and decide, okay, we haven't completely whipped inflation, but it's close enough for now. So it's kind of like if you watch Olympic wrestling, okay, the Fed in the past, our recent past, most of our investment lifetime, if you think of two wrestlers in the Olympics, you got a guy in the red suit and a guy in the blue suit. The guy in the red suit tackles and pins the guy in the blue suit. That's what historically the Fed has been doing since 1981 with Paul Volcker when he took the war of inflation on. What didn't happen prior to that was in the 60s and 70s. Now, again, if I'm going to quote Alan Greenspan, the second longest running Fed chairman in history, he said the decade, he didn't say one round of inflation early in the 2020s. He said the next decade, talking about the 2020 to 2030, will be similar to the 1970s. He said it'll be an era of stagflation. We have slower economic growth with much higher rates of inflation. And we are going to talk about Trump and his effect on that in just a moment. So I'm not discounting that. But essentially what happened in the 70s was they would allow inflation to get down. They say, okay, that's far enough. Then they would start expansionary policies again, and inflation would come right back. That's what I'm concerned about in the second half of this.
So the blue wrestler popped up for a little while.
The blue wrestler never got pinned.
Right.
He never got pinned. He wiggled out from under there.
He was taken down, but not
pinned. Yeah, but he was never pinned. And so that's the whole issue with the Fed right now. They're going to cut rates marginally, probably, but they're not going to cut rates anything like the economy and the market and everybody was expecting. So,
which I also would add, all of our researchers agree with that thought.
Right.
That the market is pricing in way too many cuts that they don't see when they look at it from an economic basis, from even the theoretical basis.
Exactly. The weakest part of the market right now is the housing market, and we'll talk about that. But it's unlikely they're going to see a huge amount of cuts by the Fed, and it's because, again, the Fed has a dual mandate. They have to fight inflation, and they have to fight not letting the economy go into recession at the same time. They know right now Powell is a war hawk. He's an inflation hawk, and he always has been, which is why Trump tried to fire him before and couldn't succeed in doing that because he's exempt from being fired. He can resign, but he cannot be fired until I think it's May of next year, when he'll be replaced by Trump almost certainly at that point. But the bottom line is simple. He's always been an inflation hawk. He's always pictured himself to be another Paul Volcker who cut inflation down, started the war, the successful war against inflation in the 1980s. And they're just not going to be cutting a lot of rates from here. Now, the bad part about that, so the good news is the economy doesn't need it right now. So a few more cuts are likely, but not what was anticipated before the election. The problem is it's affecting certain sectors of the economy really badly. And the biggest part of that is the housing market. Permits continue to fall. New construction continues to fall. We haven't seen layoffs at this point, massive layoffs in the home industry. But I think if something doesn't turn around, those are coming. Because right now, my daughter, by the way, is in real estate. She does, you know, very high end. She's one of the top producers, I will proudly say, in the state of Texas for her firm that she works with. But the bottom line is it's a stagnant, very dead market right now because housing prices, as we all know, skyrocketed. Freddie Mac interest rates, which bottomed at 2.5, can you believe 2.5, 3 years ago, are now at 6.8. They're going back up again. Why? Because the Fed is not cutting rates like they thought. And so the issue is you're starting to build new home inventory. So there's not enough inventory in the resale market. It's still, last time I checked, at like 4 months. Equilibrium is 6 months of supply. So if you have 6 months of supply of houses on the market, you're exactly at equilibrium. The last time I checked, which was last week, the existing home market is still around 4 months. The new homes are higher, and they're climbing, and that's a problem. 9.5 million in inventory right now. So the issue is that's going to put pressure on it, but keep in mind new homes are a smaller percentage. It's less than 20% of the homes on the market, what the home builders are going to build. So, and they have more incentives and so forth, but the bottom line is a big part of our economy is just sputtering right now, and that looks to be the case for a while.
All right, so now that we've talked about stocks and economy, looking forward, what is Trump's agenda? How does that impact what's going to happen?
And there's so much material on this right now. We're probably going to have to take this in bite-sized chunks over several weeks of the show. Here's what I started out writing about Trump 2.0. Number one, positive for stocks in 2025, most likely. But keep in mind, it could be most of our analysts that have been the most correct are signaling a lot more volatility than we've seen recently. Because again, we had that kind of final wave of growth that I think is ending now due to the pumping all the money into the system from the deficits and all that. We're going to talk about that in a moment. And can you really make the government efficient? Is that possible? Where is that going to lend us? We're going to talk about that in a moment. But the bottom line is, so far, the market outlook for stocks looks still positive into 2025, but I think it's going to have a lot more volatility.
And that's the positivity is coming from the fact that Trump is known for deregulation.
Right.
He's known for bringing taxes down on businesses.
Right.
So he's a business-friendly president, and so that's why the market has a more positive outlook.
They do. At the same time, the caveats are he's going to start another trade war, and the question is when.
Right.
So the last time he started a trade war, the S&P 500 was down 18% in a few weeks. But, and again, so I'm not trying to be negative. I'm not trying to be bearish. I'm not trying to justify getting bearish too soon on this one, which I did in the last newsletter. But the S&P 500 today is 30% more expensive than it was under the first trade war. So there could be some fireworks here, just depends, but a whole lot of it depends on factors you cannot possibly predict how they're going to come out. What's going to happen if he puts sanctions on Iran again, which I think is pretty certain? Well, they can still pirate their supplies. They can still sell to Russia and India. India is not a part of the evil axis building for the next World War III kind of deal, but India is going to look after India. You know, they really don't care what the United States thinks. And they're the fastest growing economy in the world right now with their size, 1.4 billion people. But again, so the issue here is really we've got to see that the trade war my big question, and I don't know anybody knows this. I don't even know if Trump has decided on this. When does he start with the tariffs? Is that something Trump doesn't have to worry about being reelected? Does he start out with the tariff wars right out of the bat? Is that round number one in the boxing match? Ding, 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 ding. Okay, they're coming out slugging and Trump's going to come out. Okay, is that going to, are we going to start the whole thing next year with Trump wars, with tariff wars? I don't know. If it were me, I wouldn't start that way. But he might, because he tends to be a bit on, and I'm saying this in a good way, because he's not intimidated by the forces that be. But he can be belligerent at times, and he can be, he makes his mind up, just get out of his way, personality. Which at this point in time, we need a reformer. So I'm not, you know, I'm just saying it's a positive, to me it's a big positive that he's in there, and I certainly voted for him. But there are some side effects to his abrasive behavior.
Yes.
From time to time. All right, so if he starts another trade war right off the bat in 2025, that's not going to go well for the market. The last one, again, you had an 18% decline in the S&P 500. But again, we're 30% higher, more expensive stocks are today. Fiscal policy, that's going to be his biggest challenge. Bank credit analyst is projecting that without changes, this is without Elon Musk, and we're going to talk about Elon and Vivek in just a moment, about their changes and how can you, is it possible to reform the federal government? I'm looking at, this is from Western Journal headline, Musk, Ramaswamy lay out exact plan for destroying federal bureaucracy. Not trimming it, destroying it. Is that possible? Do those numbers work? Can you make that happen? Will a baby boomer retirement overwhelm the system? These are huge challenges. Mm-hmm. Trump is not going to touch the entitlements at all. He's already told us that. There's a lot to be done here. There's a lot on the plate of this one. We'll talk about that in the second half of the show. But for the market, based on current projections, bank credit analysts are saying 9% deficit to GDP could be what we see next year based on what Trump's already promised. The cuts in revenue, like tips and all that, some of that's just marginal around the edges. But the bottom line, as they said, they don't think it'll probably come in that high, but a 6% deficit to GDP is likely. That is still grossly high. That is idiotic. Do we have an Iran 2.0 crisis by September? They named September as the date between January and September. That does look like it's coming to a head one way or another. The question is how? And the answer is, I don't know.
Well, we will have a guest next week that will give us some insight on how that could affect oil.
Yep.
We're going to be interviewing Matthew Ike
again. We just interviewed him last week. We played an old interview from last week, and I was listening to the show. I usually drive around in my car on Mondays. I did it yesterday instead. We're taping this, by the way, on Wednesday. And I listened to it twice, and I thought it's such a great interview.
Still
phenomenal
is.
Information. But there were some things that are out of date because of the election. So we're going to have him back
get an
again
update from him
next week, and he's going to talk about the Trump 2.0 as the OPEC and oil and all that stuff. But the issue is bank credit analyst thinks that there will be a crisis in the Iran situation where push will come to shove by September of next year. Is that going to be good for the economy? Is that going to be good for the market, the tariffs? There are some hidden landmines here that we have to look out for next year. So I'm not trying to be bearish, and I'm not bearish right now. All I can tell you right now is the Santa Claus rally is here, and enjoy that time. But what happens next year could be quite different. We'll see. The longer term, if I look at the Trump for a four-year term, the longer term part, I like everything he's trying to do, just about. I understand trying to get China to play by the rules. The tariffs are a negotiating tactic. I understand he does that. At the same time, free trade is the best policy in the long run, but you got to get the other people to play by the same set of rules you're playing by. You can't allow two sets of rules. Oh, well, the The team with the black jerseys on, they get to foul seven times per game, and the Mavericks only get to foul three times a game. You've got to get them to play by the same rules. So I do think that you're going to see there are certain types of taxes he's talked about taking and making them exempt. I think that's – I don't know. I mean, I understand that to me is pandering to the masses in terms of our taxes are too high in America over and out. If you look at the rest of the industrialized world, we are on the low end of the scale. If you compare taxes in America, believe it or not, as much patriotism as we all have, we're still lowest taxed of the major developed economies out there, just about. New Zealand's tax rates are higher. So the issue here is that we've got, but the problem is we've got an out-of-control budget. We've got an out-of-control government. And I'm going to read you one quote, which I think this is a positive about what I'm think we're seeing right now. This is taken from our book, From Boom to Bust and Beyond, page 146, The Cycle of Liberty. You go from spiritual faith, courage, liberty, abundance, selfishness, complacency, apathy, fear, dependence, back into bondage, and then back to spiritual faith. We'll talk about that from the break.
All right, we just want to take a moment to remind you that you can learn more about Cornerstone Financial at our website, cornerstonereport.com. That's cornerstonereport.com. On the site, again, you can learn about us. You can get Jerry's special report. You can catch old radio shows if you missed one. Yeah, we still highly recommend. We did part of the show last week. We replayed an interview with Matthew Ike of U.S. Energy talking about the outlook of energy, of oil, of green energy, all different types of energy. And it's still a very good interview, still probably the one I recommend the most to people. But next week, we will get an update from Matthew Ike. We're going to have him in studio and do an interview with him so we can get an update. So it sure wouldn't hurt if you missed last week's interview to go hear it.
That's
so
right.
You know all the basics excellent. Of what we talked about.
It was excellent. And you just have to realize it was done a year ago before we knew Trump was going to win. So there occasionally they'll hear something, wait a minute, that's not true, well, or that's inaccurate or whatever, but that was accurate at the time it was done. Mm-hmm. So, but I'd say 97% of the interview is still outstanding. I know a lot about oil. I wouldn't consider myself the biggest expert in the oil. You know, Matthew does this full time and has for many years, and he works in a company that he started with many years ago. But the point is, I know a lot about it. And I still got a lot of good things out of that interview. I listened to it twice. So I would encourage you to go to our website, listen to the interview on oil with Matthew Ike. If you didn't hear last week's show, and then what you can do is that will get you set up for the next one that's mm-hmm. coming next week. Because, again, as Matthew pointed out, last year, and I got this wrong when I introduced him last week, when I introduced the old interview, he said we spent $5 trillion so far in alternative energy, and we have not replaced one half of the increase in the demand.
For oil.
For oil, yep. Globally. So you can be a doom and gloomer all you want. The people on the far left tend to be extremely, they're just out to lunch on this. They have their confirmation bias blinders on. Because if you look at where the world is headed, and this is one of the good things about our book, From Boom to Bust and Beyond. I had an interviewer when we first brought this out. He was a radio guy in Washington, D.C., who was doing an interview with me. And he said, your book, he said, it's a doom and gloom book. And then he stopped and he goes, no, it's not a doom and gloom book. He said, it's very intense. But he said, you leave us with a lot of hope at the end. And so that's what we want to do is I do believe we're going through a process. As we've talked about this many times, the process is the caterpillar going into a cocoon, into the chrysalis phase, and then into the butterfly, the monarch butterfly. I see signs. I see great signs right now that the monarch butterfly is on the way. But the chrysalis phase before you get there is rough.
Yeah,
and I think we're in that period of time. I think that's going to be about a 10-year period from now until about 2034, and then we're going to be something completely different. The good news is, if you look at the history of the fourth turnings, and I didn't intend to get into this in great detail, but I guess I'm going to. Bottom line is, fourth turnings are where you have cataclysmic changes in a society. And in America, we've seen four of them previous. We saw King Philip's War, which is an all-out Indian uprising in the late 1600s. We had the Revolutionary War in 1770s and 80s. We had the Civil War. We had World War II and the Great Depression. We're in the fifth one now. And you can see, even though the far left radicals have been quiet since the election, something tells me they just haven't gone away. They're like sitting around now, we're going, oh, well, we're not going to go throw firebombs on everybody and protest and bus people in from California, college students, to protest in Austin over a bill about abortion, which they've done. And that's probably George Soros money kind of guys. But anyway, the bottom line is they didn't go, they're not gone. They're just kind of under the surface right now. Kind of like an alligator under the swamp. He's still there. You can see his eyes. But he's not going to be active until somebody says it's time to go. And somebody funds it, frankly. So anyway, let me always tell you that I'm an optimist long term. I want to read you a quote from Boom to Bust and Beyond. This was said by John Winthrop, and it was quoted repeatedly by Ronald Reagan. He said, we must consider, Winthrop history was, he was in the second batch. He wasn't the first group that came over in the Mayflower. He was in the second group that came over, but he was a preacher. He said, we must consider that we, meaning America, this is something he got revelation on the ship, on the boat, before he got off and started into the civilization there in America. He said, we must consider we shall be as a city upon the hill. The eyes of all people are upon us. And you tell me if that is not true with America to date. I still believe in America's calling. I do believe God has a calling on America. I don't believe it's gone away. But what we have done, in many ways, kind of like an Old Testament when they went into false gods kind of thing, we've gone into socialism, we've gone into humanism, we've gone into all these false isms, in my view, are false. I thought it was pretty cool when Tucker Carlson said there's no evidence for evolution, the evolutionary mindset. Wait a minute. Looks to me like God actually created the world and the universe, and he's actually trying to come at it from an academic, intellectualized viewpoint, not a political viewpoint. But the bottom line is here, this is a part of what we wrote about in our book, From Boom to Bust and Beyond. It's called The Cycle of Liberty, and I went through it real quick before the break, but let me go back through it right now. And you tell me where you think we are on this cycle, if we're on this cycle. I could be wrong. Maybe we're not on the cycle at all, but I think we are. The Cycle of Liberty. This was created by Andrew Tytler Frazier, or Andrew Frazier Tytler. I mean, you Google his name, you get two different versions of what his actual name. But anyway, Andrew somebody, Tytler Frazier. The Cycle of Liberty starts with bondage. When our founding fathers came over, they were fighting bondage, religious bondage,
right,
in the old world, in Europe. That took great spiritual faith for them to come over. They were persecuted. I mean, the people getting their noses cut off, people being executed for their faith, people being thrown in jail and persecuted. That's the kind of stuff that led them to make the decision. I mean, how hard would it be to say, let's uproot our whole family and all the people we know and get on a boat and sail somewhere we've never been before.
To an unknown land.
Unknown land, yeah. Where the natives may be very hostile. And by the way, the Jesuits had sent over missionaries in the 1500s. They were all martyred. Most people don't realize that's a part of history. If you don't remember it, look it up in a book called The Light and the Glory, the best book I've ever seen on American history. The point is, Blessed Are the Martyrs was the title of the chapter. They went over to try to evangelize the Indians, and they were all martyred for their faith. So the point is, the pilgrims, when they made the decision to leave everything they've ever known and go over there to the New World, they knew there was hostile territory. They also knew that Jamestown had tried and failed. Mm-hmm. Most of those people died. That civilization was abandoned. But yet they were compelled by two forces. One was persecution, and one was the desire for liberty and freedom. All right, so you start out in the cycle of liberty. It goes from bondage, which is where they were at. There was a lot of persecution against Protestants back then. They went from bondage to great spiritual faith. Their spiritual faith ultimately is what drove them to go to the New World. It wasn't seeking after money. Now, money became a big deal as we grew, especially before the first fourth turning, King's Philip's War. But spiritual faith led to the courage to say, we're going to go over there. We feel like God's calling us to do that. Ultimately, that leads to liberty. The liberty, this is how the cycle works. The liberty ultimately yields to abundance. In other words, abundance is a result of the liberty. If people, my good friend who's now with the Lord, Barry Asmus, PhD economist, one of the strongest economists I know of in the history of our country, basically he just said it this way. He said, if you give someone an opportunity in a free market society, they will make something of themselves. He said, America, if you rank American students against people in Estonia or wherever, in math or in English or any, these kids over there in those countries, they score way higher than our kids. Our American education system is really not doing a good job on this. We rank like 16th or something like that. He said, but there's entrepreneurism and freedom built into our culture. So what do? The kids are out there with a lemonade stand. So entrepreneurism is a part of American culture because it all started way back when. This all started back when. So the spiritual faith is what it took to get the courage to fight and come over here and survive. And as you may know, the original intent, the original land grant was right next to Jamestown. Because the storms were so incredible, though, the storms blew them to Cape Cod, where they frankly weren't obligated to pay anybody anything because it was free land, number one. Number two, the Native Americans that lived there were one of the most vicious Native American cultures in all of North America, and all died of a mysterious disease about 3 years before. So when the Pilgrims landed, all of a sudden now they're out here and there's nobody here. Wait a minute. There's fields that have been cleared for corn to plant. They didn't know how to do the farming. Squanto came over, who was from that tribe, but who was a good guy, who had been captured and taken to Europe and paraded around as this spectacle like he's in a circus in Europe. And then they brought him back over here, and he lands, and all of his people are gone. He walks in, literally, true story, he walks into the settlement, and one of the guys said, Indian coming. Indian? Not Indians. Indian coming. He walks in, he says, hey, you got a beer? That's literally what Squanto said. He'd gotten hooked, he liked the beer in Europe. So bottom line is, that winter and the next winter, 50% of them died. They were at one point, they were so bereft of food, because what happened was the first group came over, they didn't know how to farm, they didn't know what they were doing. Squanto tried to help them and they started getting it done, but they started out as communists. Most people don't know this. We're going to have a farm, a commune farm, and the communism will make it work. So go and farm in the commune farm. And then what happened was they nearly all starved to death. They reached a point after that where they literally had a ration. This is all in our book, From Boom to Bust and Beyond. They had rationed. They had to live on five kernels of corn per person per day. How do you sustain human life on five kernels of corn a day? I don't know, but they managed. The second winter, more of them survived. Most of them survived. The first winter, about half of them died. Squanto helped them go through that process. Anyway, so they had incredible sacrifice, incredible, horrible lives to live for a while, but they established a beachhead here that grew because they had land that someone had gotten ready for farming that was not there. And the other Native Americans who might have fought them didn't want to enter that land. They're like, no, this land is, they're demon spirits here. We're not about to cross over here where these guys are, because they knew that the other tribe had killed. And I'm not against the Native Americans, by the way, when I'm saying this. My heritage, I have full-blood Cherokee on both sides of my family. But anyway, it took great spiritual faith. It took courage. Then you had liberty that came out of all of that, which ultimately was the culmination of, the Revolutionary War. That led to abundance. Unfortunately, because of human nature, and you can see this clearly in the book of Judges, abundance tended to lead to selfishness. The selfishness gave way to complacency.
Because that generation doesn't remember how it all started.
No, and that's why
they didn't experience it.
First, fourth turning happened.
Yeah.
That generation was the third generation. They had no memory of how their grandparents had suffered, and all they cared about was more money, more gold, more land, you name it. But that led to this cycle, in that cycle, that period. Apathy then leads to fear, fear to dependence, dependence to bondage. Here's one question. Look at America from a political perspective today and see, is that not where we have been recently? Now,
which one is where we've been?
From apathy to fear to dependence, ultimately to bondage.
There's been a whole lot of fear.
There's been a lot of that. Now, who said fight, fight, fight? Trump. When he got shot in the ear, he said fight, fight, fight. So we're going now from the bondage phase, which the far left would take us all the way into communism if they could, the farthest of the far left, not all of them. Some of them only partly there. But they believe that's the right way to live life. They believe that's the right way, and they're wrong, in my view. But anyway, it's going to take incredible spiritual faith and courage to take us back out of this cycle again. We've been through this cycle again multiple times. So the point of this is, I'm encouraged, and I never have been a Facebook aficionado or spent a lot of time on social media until recently, but now I'm getting, I guess the algorithms have figured out what I like to read. And
they
so
do.
They're sending me stuff that I like all the time, spiritual stuff or political stuff or whatever. And essentially, it's all over the internet about how we're having revival. And this is one of the things that the authors of The Fourth Turning talked about. There's going to have to be a revival of some sort to turn the corner on this. Because they said four turnings in history, again, they happen about every 80 to 100 years. And during that 80 to 100-year cycle, essentially, you're going to either go one or two ways. They said the fourth turning will not, the cycles of history don't predict the outcome. They do predict what you're going into. And if you look back at that book, it talked about the potential, the crisis, which starts the whole process, could be a financial collapse like we had in 2008. It could be where one political party takes complete control of all government, president, Senate, House, and does things that their opponents have darkly warned they would always do if they were given power. They even predicted a possible Tea Party coming out of that. They predicted a pandemic would likely occur. That this book is so prophetic, it's amazing. Now, they did say that the timing sometime between the year 2005 and 25 is when it would start. Started in 08. There's a really good interview on the fourth turning. Just Google Neil Howe, who's one of the authors. The other authors passed away. And he did, I don't remember the guy's name off the top of my head, but he did an interview with a guy from India who's an American. Michael can be looking it up while we're talking here. I thought it was a great interview. Skip the first 30 minutes. It gets boring and bogged down, but after that, it's incredibly good. He thinks that we're having the culmination of the fourth turning around 2032 or 4, somewhere in that time frame. So the issue here is, I believe the process, Michael, has started. That's where the good news to me is right now. We still have a bloated bureaucracy. We still have corruption. We still have the forces of the far left that are at war with our way of life. But we're seeing, and you've seen not only revivals like the one in the Jesus movie in California, Baptisms in the Ocean, you've seen massive revivals throughout the Southeast in the colleges. So what I'm seeing here is that this cycle is still happening, but I'm seeing a positive resolution to it all, but with great difficulty between now and 2034, 25.
The interview Jerry was referring to is a podcast by PBD, Patrick Bet David. So PBD podcast, if you just look up PBD, Neil Howe interview or Fourth Turning interview, you'll find it. It's very good. All right, Jerry. So we got you going on the fourth turning, the big cycles of America. So that's important. We look at that, especially in the long term of where we're headed and how that will affect things we invest in, especially things that invest for longer term.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm also interested in Doge.
Yes.
What do you think about Doge?
I'm all in favor of it. What I don't believe we should do is think of it like it's about time to watch The Wizard of Oz again. It's nearing Christmas. Click your heels and it's all going to go away, Dorothy. You know, wave your magic wand. It's not going to go away automatically.
Well, and for those who don't know Doge, it's the Department of Government Efficiency that Trump is creating
right
with Elon Musk. And then I always forget the other gentleman's name.
The guy's name is Vivek Ramaswamy, I believe I got
so
it
they're,
right.
You know, have done extremely well in the business world.
Right.
He wants them to come in and cut government spending.
And that is a big step in the right direction.
I did find it interesting.
There are a lot of challenges with that.
And I forgot that, you know, Reagan did this to a degree.
Yep.
He brought in a businessman.
The Grace Commission. That's right.
He brought in a businessman to try to cut expenses. Even Clinton had Al Gore, the inventor of our internet, to go in and try to cut spending. So this has been done before to attempt it at different levels of success.
Right.
You know, it hasn't been consistent either time or it keeps going.
No.
And so, I mean, that's my biggest hope is they can get in there, get it started, but get something that keeps going.
In the past, it's kind of been like you've got a tumor and you cut back the tumor a little bit and then it keeps growing over time. And that's where I think we're likely still headed. And I hope I'm wrong on this one. The spending here is just out of control. Now, I'm going to read you from John Malden's newsletter. This is going to take us several shows to unpack all this stuff. So I want to tell you, first off, that I'm fully in favor of what they're trying to do. Fully in favor. I just don't think it's going to be as easy as it is sounding in the media right now, the reports that we're getting. The stimulus
but
right
now.
But
they do have different departments of the government very worried about their jobs.
I'm sure they do, and they need to be.
Yes.
Because there is corruption and graft. I'll briefly share, you know, my wife went up there to work on one department with a friend of ours named Andrea Lafferty up there, who's a long time. She was a Reaganite. And they tried to tackle the National Institutes of Health to show the corruption, the graft, and you name it. And I'm talking about, $750,000 to study how do prostitutes spread venereal diseases at truck stops. I mean, all sorts of just garbage spending that nobody seemed to know or care. And the way they pass these bills, they make them an emergency and nobody reads them, and they throw all sorts of earmarks in there for all these people. So again, we don't want to be negative, but we got to be realistic about it, because right now the government debt is just in a runaway freight train mode. So we have to revolutionize the thing. So the question is, what are we going to do? In order to become the caterpillar, or the butterfly rather, we got to go through the chrysalis phase, which is the roughest part of the whole process, and that's what I think we're starting to do. Now, Elon wants to trim $2 trillion in spending. $2 trillion. That is a lot. Let me give you, and there's a really good graphic in here from FRED, which is the federal government current expenditures. It showed that our spending before 2020, before COVID, was running under $5 trillion. Then it spiked under COVID, which we know was emergency measures, to $9 trillion. Then it went back down. Then we had the big surge in spending when Biden and his team got in, and it went back down, but it's never gotten back to the baseline, never come back to the trend. The government spending now, so in 2015, the federal government was spending under $4 trillion a year. Now it's spending $7 trillion a year. Okay, if you can get somehow to cut $2 trillion of spending, you'll get back to the baseline. What are the odds of taking a $7 trillion budget down by $2 trillion? When you've got Medicare and Social Security, which are growing as entitlements because the baby boomers are getting more older, and those trust funds basically are fictional in the first place, but they're going to run out of, quote, money, even though it's just a bookkeeping entry, before too long. And as you and I talked about, the most expensive part of those entitlements is Medicare. And Medicare is the big gorilla on the entitlement program. And the vast majority, unless there's a massive reform in this department, which is, Trump's already said he's not going to touch the entitlements. He's already said that. So he's not even looking at touching that. Ken Dykewall pointed out in his book, Age Wave, that the most expensive part of Medicare is the last 9 months of a final illness, when people will do anything they can to try to stay alive a little longer, and it's massively expensive. So again, I'm not trying to be negative. I'm trying to be realistic here, because I don't think that you can turn this thing around easily or on a dime. And frankly, I think it's going to be a trimming of the budget and not a solving of the budget deficit over the long run. You got the entitlement issues. You've got constituencies. When my wife went up to work with Andrea Lafferty on the ridiculous fraud in the National Institutes of Health, which again is one government agency, she went to Kay Bailey Hutchison. No offense to her, she was the chairman of that board, but the government's just out of control. It wasn't. I'm not blaming her for it. Mm-hmm. She parked herself in that office for Kay Bailey and would not leave. And she told the staff, I'm not leaving until I talk to someone important. And they tried to take her in the conference room. She said, no. Finally, she got the chief of staff. She showed him, she set him up. He said, ma'am, I promise you we're not going to cut your spending. We're not going to cut your entitlement. She flipped open a book that showed some college professors in drag out on party being paid for by the National Institutes of Health, and he nearly flipped over backward in his chair. He recoiled from it. And he said, that's not the National Institutes of Health. She said, it's on your website. My wife can be fearless at the appropriate times. So anyway, here we are, and we're running out of time for the show, and I don't want to leave us on a negative. I am optimistic that they're going to do some good in this. And what I'm seeing are the beginnings of reform, true beginnings of reform. I don't see it's going to be easy. We've been through some cancer battles with my wife, not me. I know there's it's tough. It's going to be a tough fight, but I'm optimistic in the long run America prevails and that we come out of this in good shape, but don't underestimate the war.
All right, join us next week with an updated interview with Matthew Locke.
Jerry Tuma's Smart Money is a broadcast of Cornerstone Financial Services of Dallas, Texas. Jerry Tuma is a certified financial planner. Financial advisors at Cornerstone could help you if you prefer to delegate your investment decisions to a financial professional. Securities and advisory services offered through Independent Financial Group, LLC, a registered investment advisor, member FINRA, SIPC. Cornerstone Financial Services, an independent financial group, LLC, or unaffiliated entities. We publish a newsletter, Cornerstone Report, which is available on our website or by calling our toll-free number at 800-327-4285. That's also the number to call for more information about anything we've discussed during today's broadcast. For more information, visit our website at cornerstonereport.com. Views and opinions heard on Jerry Tuma's Smart Money are not necessarily the opinion of this station or its management or Independent Financial Group, LLC, its affiliates, officers, or directors. Material on this program is intended for general information only and should not be taken as specific investment, tax, or legal advice. Remember, we are aiming to change the way America thinks about investing.